Post in Ireland, she would have loved a crack at him. But there was a helicopter waiting. Often the way, in her experience. Even Eddie Flood had a certain rugged charm, though she is increasingly coming to suspect that he has been hired by a Russian chemicals billionaire to kill her. What a way to go, though. All that frustration, all of those missed opportunities, and still she hasn't turned her headlights on Steve. That's real progress. She looks forward to reporting back to her therapist on this with well-earned pride. See, Jonathan, I do have boundaries. In fact, now she thinks about it, Jonathan was the last person she slept with. Jeff Nolan can't sleep. The two nights in a ditch, idyllic and back to basics, though it was in some ways, have not been kind to his back, and Steve's sofa is finishing the job. He misses the lovely spare room bed, but he was never going to take that from Rosie. He is half tempted to tiptoe upstairs, knock on Steve's door, and ask if they could share for the night. But Steve's only experience of him so far involves him faking his own death and then breaking into his house, so it might still be a little early in their relationship to be roommates. At least this sleeplessness is giving him time to think. He will head back to London in the morning. Steve had composed a simple email to send to Lou Bay's encrypted email address. Dear Mr. Lou Bay, we know you are in Dubai, and we know about Max Highfield and Rob Kenner. We are coming to find you. There's really no point in sending it, but Steve was very keen. Let's flush everyone out, had been the logic. Jeff is a little jealous that trouble is upstairs with Steve. He thought they had a bond. Henk van Veen is wide awake, walking down the high street. Tony Taylor's sofa had been surprisingly comfortable, and he was settling very nicely when the sounds of vigorous lovemaking reached him from the floor above, and he thought it might be a good time to take the air. Upon returning an hour later, he found that the noises were, if anything, louder still, so he headed straight back out again. Max Highfield, though, really? And does he trust Jeff now? Well, no. Henk finds a bench by the pond and sits down. There is a plaque on the bench, dedicated to a woman named Debbie. Nice to be remembered. Nice to be loved. Henk doesn't see his family so much. One day he would like to again, but how does one go about healing wounds? Perhaps he can heal his wounds with Jeff too. They were a good team. Bonnie Gregor can't sleep. She's just had a thought about what her mum said the other day. The moment when they ask, did you pack these bags yourself? What happens if you say, no? She's never heard anyone say that, so she doesn't know. On reflection, it's probably best to say that she did, isn't it? Yes, that's probably what people do. Go back to sleep, Bonnie. Eddie Flood can't sleep. He has become a prisoner to the alarm setting on his iPhone. Once, Eddie set a 7 a.m. alarm for 7 p.m. by mistake and, as a result, was late for a prison van hijack. Tonight, he has set the alarm on his phone for 5 a.m., and he keeps rolling over and rechecking that he set it properly. Then he checks that the alarm will work even though the volume is off. He dozes briefly and, half asleep, tells himself that his alarm has gone off, but when he checks, he sees it has only just gone midnight. What if he does fall asleep, dream that his alarm has gone off, and then, in his sleep, actually turn it off? Whether he does eventually fall asleep, or whether alarm-related sleep anxiety keeps him up all night, he will rise at 5. Wherever Rosie D'Antonio goes tomorrow, Eddie will go. He decides to read up on undetectable poisons to send himself to sleep. It's 4 a.m. in Dubai, and Max Highfield has no intention of sleeping anytime soon. He was delighted to find that the VIP room at Equinox Nightclub had its own even smaller VIP room, and that is where he is now, snorting cocaine with a boxer, a diamond dealer, and a billionaire. He's sure he has read somewhere that you're not supposed to take cocaine in Dubai. But they say you're not supposed to take cocaine in London either, and it's virtually compulsory there. And besides, if it was illegal, would a billionaire arms dealer and a boxer be doing it? Henk has given him a bodyguard. She is only 5'2", but she has already shown him how to mine for Bitcoin. Billionaires and celebrities. Max is glad that he is one, and looks forward to being the other. Amy Wheeler is fast asleep in the guest wing of Gary Goff's country home, about as safe from police officers as it is possible to be. There are busy times ahead. She will do her job, and she knows that Steve and Rosie will do theirs too. Part 3. From Dubai to a small bench by a quiet pond. Chapter 80.
He can't stay as François Loubé for much longer. That's clear now.
It was a good run. But there's too much heat. Time for a change of identity. What will it be this time? Colombian? Turkish? Change everything. Numbers, emails, the lot.
Merci beaucoup, though, François. You've had police the world over looking for you, and you never even existed.
Things change. Things stay the same. The man who was François Loubé smiles, pours himself a whiskey, and opens his emails for the final time.
Chapter 81. On the flight from St. Lucia to Dublin, when Steve first started to suspect Max Highfield, he'd read an interview in which Max had named The Rose of Sarasota as his finest film. It had taken Steve a while to track it down, as none of the usual streamers seemed to have shared Max's opinion. Having just watched the first 8 minutes of The Rose of Sarasota, Steve understands why. He only made it as far as 8 minutes in because it was at that point that Max Highfield had revealed that his character, an army explosives expert, had the nickname Joe Blow. A nice thing to add to the pile of evidence as he and Rosie fly out to Dubai. Steve sits back in his seat, but it's not as comfortable as some of the other private jets they've taken. Steve remembers that he used to buy Trouble his cat food from the local shop in Axley. You got it in pouches, 20 or so in a box. There was a duck flavour, a salmon flavour, perhaps a beef one, something like that. Trouble never stopped to ask. He just loved food that he hadn't had to catch or scavenge for himself. Then one day, Margaret next door made a roast chicken for her family and brought Steve the leftovers. Steve fed some of the roast chicken to Trouble, just as a treat, and, as anyone with a cat could have told him, from that day forward, Trouble refused to eat cat food. If you try him with it, he'll tip his head and look at you in utter incomprehension. We both know I only eat roast chicken, mate, come on. And that, Steve realises, is how he is now about private jets. This private jet, it's a Learjet, is slightly smaller than the ones he has become used to in the last week, and he's feeling a little cramped. He's also just found out that there is no private chef, and he had really been looking forward to a bacon sandwich. So, just as cat food has been ruined for Trouble, so air travel has now forever been ruined for Steve. Which is actually fine by him, because as soon as they trap Max Highfield and talk to Rob Kenner, and as soon as they work out who François Loubé is, Steve intends never to fly anywhere ever again. He sits opposite Rosie, knees almost touching because of the slightly reduced legroom.
So we know for sure that Max Highfield is Joe Blow, says Steve. All of the influencers we know about were recruited to Maximum Impact through his recommendations, the connection with Felicity Wollaston, and now the name.
Bang to rights, agrees Rosie. Thanks to you.
Is this private jet a bit too small, do you think?
Steve shakes his head in shock.
Rosie, I'm not the sort of person who goes around thinking that private jets are too small.
Oh my God, says Rosie.
You do think it's too small.
You'll be complaining there's no chef next.
Steve waves this away, but not for the first time, feels utterly naked in front of Rosie's gaze.
We just need to be able to outwit Max Highfield.
How are you going to get to him, though? Rosie asks.
According to Tatler, Max Highfield is the world's 14th biggest film star.
You could get a meeting with him, Steve suggests, as the world's second biggest author.
Steve had caught Rosie putting her books in front of Lee Child's at the W.H. Smith in the airport.
Maybe, says Rosie. Usually, when a celebrity meets another celebrity, they only ever talk about Tom Cruise or how much tax they paid last year.
But perhaps I could pitch him an idea.
Steve nods, and Rosie takes out her phone. Steve looks out of the window. Where are they flying over? Bulgaria, perhaps? If you fly over somewhere, can you say you've been there? That would be handy. Think of the places he'll have been then.
Are you still worried that Eddie Flood is trying to kill you?
Rosie shrugs, but unconvincingly.
Certainly, if he turns up in Dubai, we'll know it's trouble. Or if Vasily Karpin puts in an appearance.
Well, says Steve, I honestly hope no one kills you.
That means a lot, Stevie. Thank you, says Rosie. That's the closest you've ever come to flirting with me.
Did you enjoy the quiz? Steve asks.
The quiz, says Rosie. God, no.
Only I saw you laughing quite a lot, says Steve.
I'm on painkiller medication.
Steve smiles.
There's always a place on the team for you.
I don't do pub quizzes, Stevie, says Rosie. I live on a private island.
By yourself, says Steve.
Yes, that's what makes it private, says Rosie.
You don't get lonely,
says the man whose best friend is a cat.
They both laugh.
Steve looks down at the map on the flight computer. They're now over Armenia.
That's another country ticked off the list. Armenia, yep, been there, very hilly.
I'm not lonely, says Rosie. That's not the word. There are just fewer people around nowadays. Fewer friends.
People die, says Steve.
And a lot more people die when you get to my age, says Rosie.
Remind me what age that is again?
Asks Steve.
30 years younger than my first husband, says Rosie, and 30 years older than my next husband.
There are still plenty of people out there, says Steve. Plenty of friends, if you want them.
But they'll die too, says Rosie, won't they?
Everybody dies.
That's the spirit, says Steve.
Ugh, ignore me, says Rosie. A bit of me thinks if Vasily Karpin did kill me, would that be such a bad thing?
I said the same to Debbie the other day, says Steve.
About me dying, not you dying.
Would Debbie have liked me?
Rosie asks.
She'd have loved you, says Steve.
And you'd have loved her.
She was more fun than me.
I do want to catch Liu Bei, says Rosie. But I'll be sad when this is all over.
What do you think Amy and Jeff are up to?
Going through all the records back in London, says Steve. Seeing when Max started to get involved, finding any clues to Liu Bei's identity.
And we trust Jeff? Rosie asks.
Why wouldn't we? Says Steve.
Unless you think he's been sending the Liu Bei emails to himself.
Rosie goes back to her phone. Steve tries to get comfortable. Tony Taylor used to send emails to himself as part of an elaborate tax fraud.
Too elaborate for Tony, anyway. That's why he's not allowed to do MOTs anymore.
Steve looks over at Rosie again. Are they friends now? Will they stay in touch after all this?
Always assuming they're both still alive.
Steve has a thought. This might be crazy, says Steve. But are we certain that Max Highfield isn't François Liu Bei himself?
I'm not sure he has the brains, says Rosie. I saw an interview with him in Vanity Fair.
in which he hadn't heard of Ukraine. Perhaps he's street smart, says Steve.
He also thought Princess Diana was fictional, says Rosie.
Who is Francois Loubet, says Steve. It's driving me crazy.
You worked out that Max Highfield is Joe Blow, says Rosie. You worked out that Rob Kenner is working for Loubet, and now one of them will lead us to Francois Loubet.
Steve nods. Rosie's right. Just keep following the clues. By the way, did you notice the loo roll in the toilet isn't double ply?
I never go to the toilet, Stevie, says Rosie, looking up from her phone.
You know that. As he sprays a lavender chamomile and musk mist onto his goose-down pillow, Steve realizes he's going to miss all this too. Chapter 82.
The journey to Heathrow Airport hadn't taken as long as you'd think, and Bonnie is relieved that she's arrived in plenty of time for her plane. Her next-door neighbour's husband was kind enough to carry her leather hold-all, what you got in here, gold bars, all the way to the check-in queue. Bonnie's struggling behind with her big case on its wonky wheels. The line is long. Lucky Bonnie got here early. You just never knew. She'll be happy to get the case and the bag off her hands. And then there's security to get through too. Who knows how long that might take? She looks at the clock on the wall. Plenty of time, Bonnie, plenty of time. As the queue inches forward in front of her, Bonnie uses her foot to push the leather hold-all forward. Doesn't feel like tins of paint. Perhaps that's the point. No more tins. Paint in a bag. Could be, couldn't it? Maxie and Mimi were excited to see her off this morning. They waved from the front door, and she promised to bring them presents. Her mum was crying, so Bonnie promised to bring her back a big bar of Toblerone. But her mum said, just bring yourself back safely. Bonnie nudges the bag forward once again. Heavy, but with a bit of give. Why in the world is she doing this? Is she an idiot for taking a bag on a plane when she has no idea what's in it? Could be a bomb, couldn't it? That's like something her mum would have said. But her mum doesn't understand Instagram. There are only two check-in desks open. Perhaps she should email Felicity while she waits, just to put her mind at rest. She composes an email on her phone. Felicity, hi. On my way to sunny Sao Paulo, at the airport, in plenty of time. Super quick one. They've given me a bag with a lock on it, and I don't know what's in it. It's for a surprise unboxing video. Bit 2022, right? Just checking this is normal. Sorry to be a pain. First time and everything. Thanks again. I owe you so much. Bonnie. Her finger hovers above the send button as she rereads it. Imagines Felicity in her office reading it. She moves her finger away. No. Felicity will think she's a drama queen. Come on, Bonnie, you're a grown-up. She imagines Felicity forwarding this email onto her colleagues with a few cry-laugh emojis. What if Forest Paints get to hear about it? The influencer who thought their paint samples were a bomb. Next, please, says a smiling woman at one of the check-in desks. Bonnie sends the email to Drafts and gives her leather hold-all a series of shuffling kicks towards the desk. She hands over her passport. Where are you flying to today, my love? Asks the check-in clerk. Sao Paulo, says Bonnie. Ooh, lovely, says the clerk, checking her passport. Little holiday. Business, actually, says Bonnie, feeling 10 feet tall. The clerk looks at Bonnie's case and hold-all. And just the two bags to check in? Bonnie nods. Stick them on the scales for me, my darling, says the clerk. What's your booking number? Bonnie lugs the hold-all onto the rubber conveyor belt next to the check-in desk and hands over her booking confirmation. And you pack the bags yourself, Bonnie? The moment she hears the question, Bonnie knows she should have sent the email, just to be certain. She'll be worried there's a bomb in the hold for the whole flight. Good luck enjoying a Jennifer Aniston film now. But if it was a bomb, she'd have been able to feel it, surely. It felt softer than that. What if it's drugs? But why would it be? She had sat face to face with Felicity. They even went to Pizza Express, for goodness sake. Yes,
says Bonnie. Felicity is not going to send Bonnie to Sao Paulo with a hold-all full of drugs. You're an influencer now, Bonnie, so act like an influencer, not a child. As Bonnie is about to put the case with the wonky wheels onto the belt, the clerk scans her confirmation QR code.
Oh, my darling, she says. You're on the 4 p.m. flight.
Bonnie nods. The clerk looks at her watch.
Only it's 9:30 in the morning.
I didn't want to miss the flight, says Bonnie. In the end, they had left at 8:30 because she was packed and ready, and what harm could it do to get there a bit early?
Your check-in doesn't open till 1, says the clerk.
There's a Costa and a Boots if you get bored.
Do you want to pop your bag back down for me?
Bonnie heaves the first bag back off the belt.
Better to be early than late, though, isn't it?
I'll sit in Costa for a bit, thank you, says Bonnie.
Probably costs you as much as the flight, laughs the clerk.
I know, says Bonnie, now swinging the heavy hold-all back down to the floor. Who has that kind of money?
Chapter 83. Amy is curled up in the boot of Gary Goff's Land Rover. He has kindly agreed to drive her all the way to London. As it happens, he needs to be there for a lunch with an amphetamine dealer from Liverpool anyway, so he promises it is no inconvenience. There are police officers all over Axley and the surrounding villages looking for her. That's why she's in the boot. An officer had even knocked at Gary Goff's door last night, and Gary had pointed to the name of his house, carved into a beautiful New Forest log. Amy hadn't noticed before that Gary Goff's house is called No Comment. She could probably have got out of the boot by now as they speed up the M3, but it is comfortable and comforting. Gary had sent her a text message from the front seat asking if she was okay, and she had texted back a thumbs up and a ZZZ, so he'd left her in peace. She feels bad sending Steve and Rosie on their own to Dubai, but she has no choice but to lie low. Whatever evidence has appeared at the scenes of the three crimes will, no doubt, be very bad for her. Her only hope is that they can discover who Francois Loubet is and stop him. She also feels nervous that Steve and Rosie are in Dubai together. Who knows what the two of them will do without what she considers to be her calming presence. Gary is going to drop her in the underground car park of Maximum Impact, where she will spend the night. Tomorrow, she and Jeff are going to go through the Francois Loubet files with a magnifying glass to help the cause. Neither of them is great with files, but that's their only option for now. In the boot, Amy finds a metal case, and inside the case, there are two handguns. She texts Gary and asks if she can take one. He replies with a thumbs up and a gun. She always feels safer with two guns. There's another thing she's worrying about. Steve is staying with Adam at the villa. You could tell they were both sort of mortified when they realised it would be just the two of them there. Rosie was about to offer Steve a room in her hotel, but Amy hushed her. It will do Steve and Adam some good, spending some time with each other. Father and son. It's healthy. But Amy can't help wondering what they'll be talking about. They both talk about Debbie with Amy, but never with each other. As Amy feels the car slow from the speed of the motorway to the crawl of London, she hopes they are talking about Debbie now. Chapter 84.
Flew over on Tuesday, yeah, says Adam. Steve nods. Got the plane, yeah?
Got the plane, confirms Adam.
Best thing, says Steve. Be a long time in a boat.
Long time, agrees Adam.
When was the last time Steve and his son had chatted without somebody else in the room? Even at Christmas, if Amy pops into the kitchen to make a cuppa, Adam will say, let me help you. And if he doesn't say, let me help you, Steve will say it instead. Anything but being stuck together.
You know where the loo is? Adam asks. If you need it.
Hallway, says Steve.
Clocked it on the way in. Adam nods and sips his tea again.
What did they used to talk about?
Dinosaurs, when Adam was very young, but conversation has been limited since then. Two awkward men on either side of a canyon of silence. Steve tries something.
How's the flush?
He says.
Good water pressure?
Dad, says Adam. We could talk about the murders, you know.
Well, okay, says Steve. I didn't know if you'd be interested.
I'm interested, says Adam.
I don't go to prisons in Dubai to visit dead women very often.
They're trying to kill Amy, says Steve.
I mean, that's another reason why I'm interested, says Adam. Do you know who?
A man called Rob Kenner, hired by a man called Francois Loubet.
And they're in Dubai?
Kenner is, for sure, says Steve. That's why I popped into the golf club on the way here. Kenner was sitting at the bar wearing sunglasses indoors. He's a DJ.
A DJ's trying to kill Amy? She must hate that.
Did you speak to him?
No need to make a fuss in public, says Steve.
I'll get him.
He was playing golf with an old Cockney bloke who looked like a talker.
Adam nods.
And where's Francois Loubet?
Where's Loubet isn't the question, says Steve. The question is, who's Loubet?
Okay, says Adam.
Who's Loubet?
That's what I'm trying to find out, says Steve.
The two men sit in silence for a while longer. Every time Steve thinks of something to say, he gets embarrassed.
What does Adam want to hear?
They occasionally give each other a little smile and nod. Adam is having the same struggle. Steve can tell.
Perhaps one day he should talk to Adam about Deb.
I might hit the hay, says Adam.
Long day.
Good idea, says Steve. Great idea. Problem solved. I'm going to see if there's anything on the telly.
Yeah, says Adam.
Adam stands and salutes goodnight. This is to avoid a hug both of them would be too embarrassed to have.
Night, Skipper, says Adam.
There are towels in the airing cupboard.
Maybe they should talk about Debbie. But how? How do you raise that sort of thing? It's just too much.
Adam reaches the door.
Stegosaurus, says Steve, taking himself by surprise.
Adam turns around.
Stegosaurus?
That was your favourite, wasn't it?
Says Steve.
Stegosaurus.
And you like to triceratops too.
Adam nods.
Didn't mind a triceratops, to be fair.
Triceratops, repeats Steve.
Diplodocus, says Adam. The two grown men look at each other, both waiting for the other to say something more. Steve finally cracks.
Can I ask you another question?
Of course, Dad, says Adam. Anything.
What are you supposed to wear in a sauna?
The pause suggests that this wasn't a question Adam was expecting.
In a sauna? Nothing, says Adam.
Just a towel.
I feared as much, says Steve.
He nods at his son, 5 feet from him, but so far away.
Airing cupboard, yeah?
Airing cupboard, says Adam.
Night, Dad.
Chapter 85.
In the end, Bonnie Gregor spent just over 3 hours in Costa Coffee. She was about to leave after 90 minutes because she thought the nice Albanian girl behind the counter was judging her for spending so long over a single cup of coffee. But then the shifts changed and she was replaced by a girl with glasses who read a book when she wasn't serving. Bonnie had also bought a lemon and poppy seed muffin because she is aware that Costa Coffee is a business and business is tough these days. She sent the email to Felicity because manners are important, and also because it is better safe than sorry, isn't it?
check-in for her flight has finally opened, and she has returned to kick-nudging her leather hold-all through the queue. Waiting had given her plenty of time to think. Working for brands like Forest Paints is all well and good, but it's her own brand she really wants to work on. So perhaps she can put some of this $20,000 towards some new equipment, new stock, stronger ideas. She knows she makes people smile, and the more people smiling in the world, the better. Would Felicity help her? As soon as she is back from Sao Paulo, Bonnie will go back to Letchworth, and they can start working on next steps. Bonnie reaches the front of the queue. The same woman is still working on the check-in desk. She flashes the same smile. "Don't tell me," she says. "Sao Paulo, business. Just bankrupted yourself in Costa." Bonnie laughs along with her and hands over her passport and boarding pass. "And the two bags," the woman says. "Just pop the case up here for me, my darling." Bonnie heaves the case with the wonky wheel up onto the belt. "And you pack this yourself?" Bonnie nods. She actually did pack this one herself. Well, with her mum's help. The woman ties a sticky label around the handle. "And the other one, my dear." Bonnie lifts up the leather hold-all. "And you pack this one yourself too?" "Mm-hmm," says Bonnie. "Mm-hmm." Just as a label is being tied to the handle of the hold-all, there is a commotion behind her in the queue. The woman looks over Bonnie's shoulder and points at someone. "There's a queue, sir." Bonnie turns to see who is causing the problem. A man in his late 50s is barging his way to the front, to the fury of the other passengers. "Sir." The man, a little out of breath, heads straight for Bonnie and snatches the leather hold-all from the belt. "That's my ba," begins Bonnie, before seeing another figure pushing to the front of the queue. Felicity Wollaston. "Felicity!" Felicity puts her hands on her knees as she catches her breath. "So sorry, Bonnie, my mistake. Booked you on the wrong flight." She nods towards Tony. "This is Tony." "Hello, Bonnie," says Tony, now taking her case off the luggage belt too, and placing it next to the hold-all. "Is everything okay, my darling?" asks the check-in clerk. "Yes, all fine," says Bonnie. "This is my agent. What's happening?" "Just a mix-up," says Felicity. "Nothing to worry about." Tony picks up the cases and leads Bonnie and Felicity away from the desks. "You got my email?" "In the nick of time," says Felicity. "We nearly didn't make it."
"Roadworks on the M3 slip road," says Tony, "as per."
"Let's get to you a Costa and have a little chat, shall we?" says Felicity. "My treat."
Chapter 86. As so often, the sun shines brightly on a brand new Dubai day. Everything is possible here. Rosie is enjoying the view from the breakfast terrace. Henk has arranged for them to have a meeting with Max Highfield before the Diamond Conference a little later this morning. She has a plan to get him to talk, or at least to find out if he's lying. Rosie will be pretending that she wants Max to star in the film of one of her books. Steve is going to play a big-shot movie producer, and Rosie is already looking forward to dressing him up. Does Max even know who Francois Loubet is, though? Amy will not be safe until he's found. All of this journey will have been wasted. But she knows Steve will find. Suddenly, a very large figure blots out the sun.
"Miss D'Antonio, I wonder if I might join you."
Rosie looks up at the obstruction. A bear of a man in a singlet and speedos. He must be very rich indeed to be wearing those in this hotel. Russian accent. She knows precisely who he is. And today, there is no Amy to protect her. While they were chasing the ghost of Francois Loubet, the flesh and blood of Vasily Karpin has been chasing her. What unfortunate timing. If she'd known she was going to die this morning,
She would have ordered the pancakes. Okay, how to play this?
I'm afraid that I have a rule, says Rosie. I won't have breakfast with anyone who wants to kill me. Lucky I don't have the same rule, says the man. I would never eat. My name is Vasily Karpin.
Rosie hadn't needed telling.
You'd better sit, Mr. Karpin. I'm assuming you can't kill me right here, but perhaps you'll prove me wrong.
Vasily Karpin lowers himself onto the chair. You had to admire chairs sometimes, those thin legs, but look at the weight they could carry.
So, Mr. Karpin, Rosie begins, are you looking for an apology or a corpse?
Oh, neither, says Vasily. I am looking for myself to apologize, even though I believe you describe my face as that of a bulldog chewing a nettle.
Not at all, says Rosie. I think that was a mistranslation. It was a bullfrog chewing a nettle.
Vasily laughs, like an elephant seal in great distress.
My wife's sister. You don't know her. She says you are right. That is what I look like.
Vasily reaches into a cloth swimming bag and Rosie tenses. He brings out a book and a pen. It is Dead Men and Diamonds.
Do you think you could sign it for her?
Rosie raises an inquiring eyebrow.
For my sister-in-law, says Vasily. She will kill me if I don't get it signed.
Of course, says Rosie, taking the book. What's her name?
Yevdokia Ivanovna.
Rosie nods. And how do I spell that?
Just the normal way, says Vasily. We were at a barbecue in Sochi, and I was angry about something. I don't know what. And I saw she had your book, and I say, oh, that's the lady I'm going to kill. And Yevdokia Ivanovna says, she's my favorite writer. She's beautiful. If you kill her, I would kill you back. And if you know my sister-in-law, you know she means it. So I said, I won't kill her.
When was this? Rosie asks.
A few weeks ago, says Vasily. Something like that.
Rosie signs the book and hands it back.
And you didn't tell anyone you'd called off the hit?
Vasily shrugs.
I call for so many hits. I call off so many hits. It would be a full-time job. So I've had a bodyguard for no reason?
No such thing as no reason, says Vasily. Everything has a reason.
He has a point there, but it does leave one loose end hanging.
So you haven't hired a man called Eddie Flood to kill me?
Never heard of him, says Vasily.
Rosie nods.
Sorry I used your name in my book. I shouldn't have, really.
I got a signed book out of it, says Vasily. And if you ever need me to kill anyone.
Vasily stands with some effort and shakes Rosie's hand.
That's terrifically kind of you, says Rosie, having to avert her eyes from the departing Russian speedos.
On the way up to her suite last night, Rosie had seen a familiar sight. Eddie Flood hiding badly. But if Eddie Flood isn't here to kill her, and he isn't here to kill Amy, what is he here for?
Chapter 87. Eddie Flood stretches and looks at his watch. He's had a good 9 hours, Kip. That'll serve him well. You have to sleep well. He's decided. Today's the day. The odds are against him, he knows that. But he's been in that position many times before. Is he nervous? Sure. But is he ready? Yes. He packs his bag and pats it for good luck. He'll follow Rosie this morning, then as soon as she's by herself in her room. That's his cue to strike. He walks over to his window and draws back the curtains. His view is of aluminium air conditioning ducts, snaking up a crumbling stone wall. Rob Kenner's 15 grand was never going to last forever. And that's why today's the day.
Chapter 88. Max Highfield is lying naked, save for some white briefs, on a sheepskin rug, with diamonds sprinkled on his bare chest. A photographer moves around him, exhorting him to look mean, Max. Look sexy, Max. Think deep thoughts. Okay, okay. Even deeper thoughts, if you can. Rosie is sitting on a yoga ball, smoking a joint.
What would my character be called?
Max looks into the distance, as if at the explosion of a distant planet he once called home.
Do you want to hear the idea first?
Rosie asks. Max's bodyguard, a woman in her 20s called Abby, who has been sitting at a laptop up to now, stands.
Okay, that's time.
Just two or three more, says the photographer, still snapping away. Abby takes the camera in her fist and places it gently on the floor.
I said that's time. Tuck's on now, Mr. Highfield.
She hands Max Highfield a tuxedo, and he turns to Rosie.
Name first, says Max. Let me get the vibe of the thing.
He's called Blake Scott, says Rosie.
I like it, says Max, grunting. Blake Scott. What does he look like?
Like you, says Rosie.
Exactly like you.
Max pulls a dress shirt over his head.
Maybe he could have a moustache.
Could do, agrees Rosie. She has dealt with, dated, and divorced many actors in her time.
I wouldn't have thought of that. That's what you get with Max Highfield, says Max Highfield.
He motions for Abby to pass him a bow tie.
So Hank says you're a writer.
Me? Says Rosie.
Yes. I wrote too,
says Max, now reaching his hand out to Abby for a thick green smoothie.
Have you sold 60 million books?
Rosie asks.
No, says Max. Books are too 20th century. I write poems, mainly.
Stream of consciousness stuff?
Not even poems, really. A whole different art form. I don't think you'd be able to describe them.
Oh, I bet I could have a go, says Rosie.
So I'm Blake Scott, says Max, and I've got a moustache. What else? It's pretty thin so far, writer.
Max nods over to Steve.
And who's he?
Steve, says Steve. I'm the producer. Max nods.
You sweat a lot, my friend.
It's very hot, says Max, and I'm wearing a suit.
I don't sweat, says Max.
No, says Rosie.
A lot of good people don't, says Max.
Okay, I don't like this idea.
You haven't heard it yet, says Rosie. I'm not feeling it, though, says Max.
This is one of the many reasons why, whenever Rosie sells one of her books to Hollywood, she doesn't like to get involved. Bank the check, turn up at the premiere, chat to Graham Norton, job done.
Also, I don't just do action, says Max. I did Shakespeare at school. But go on, I've got a couple of minutes till I'm on stage.
It's a story about money smuggling, Max, Rosie begins.
Like smuggling money, replies Max.
Yes, like that, confirms Rosie. It's the story of a syndicate that pays influencers to smuggle bags of money around the world. Not a flicker from Max, so far.
And that's illegal.
Yes, says Steve, it is.
This bloody government, says Max. Okay, so is Blake Scott an influencer?
No, says Steve. He's the one in control of the syndicate.
So he's a bad guy, says Max, finally pulling on some trousers. I don't really play bad guys.
He's nuanced, says Rosie.
I don't do nuance either, says Max. Nuance is too woke.
I've hacked into the Hampstead Dog Hotel, Abby announces, bringing her laptop over to Max. Max eagerly takes the laptop and starts cooing. Rosie raises an eyebrow at Abby. Mr. Highfield's dogs are at a residential facility in North London, says Abby. I've just hacked into their outdoor security cameras so he can see his dogs.
Is that legal? Steve asks.
Any cameras facing public spaces are legal to view, says Abby.
Very difficult to access. But legal to view.
Max is tearing up.
They look so happy. Thanks, Abby.
Abby takes the laptop back.
Would you like to hear more of the story? Rosie asks.
Sure,
says Max. Maybe Blake Scott has two dogs?
I'll note that down, says Rosie.
Only the influencers, the ones smuggling all the money, start getting shot, says Steve. One by one.
This actually happened to a friend of mine, says Max.
Yes, says Rosie.
Yeah, Jeff Nolan. Good guy.
This exact story, Rosie asks. If Max is involved in all this, he is covering it very well.
Same thing, says Max. Influencers getting shot.
I don't think they were money smugglers, though.
That's a nice twist.
You like the idea? Rosie asks.
Sure,
says Max.
Where would we film?
We'd start in South Carolina, says Steve. Then St. Lucia, then Ireland.
And we'd finish the whole thing in Dubai, says Rosie.
Sounds nice, says Max, expertly looping his bow tie. Again, no sign that any of this is ringing alarm bells for him.
Max slips into a pair of dress shoes.
Send it to my agent, tell him I said yes, but I need my character to be a good guy, make someone else the baddie, and I kill him.
There's another character who would be perfect as the bad guy, says Rosie.
Great,
says Max, heading towards the stage.
Francois Loubet.
Max thinks.
I've heard that name before.
French?
One supposes so, says Rosie. Great, says Max. I'll ask Timothy Chalamet. He's a mate. I come first in the billing, though.
Max disappears onto the stage, and they hear applause. Abby follows to the side of the stage with her laptop.
You're good, says Rosie to Abby.
I'll tell Hank.
Thank you, Mom, says Abby, and is gone.
They hear Max start his speech.
Now, what's beautiful, ultra hard, and incredibly expensive? No, not me. Diamonds. The last time I was around this many carats, I was in Sainsbury's.
Rosie turns to Steve.
Not a flicker, says Rosie, the whole way through the pitch. Because Sainsbury's is an English supermarket, you see, and they sell carrots.
But if Max isn't Joe Blow, says Steve, who is?
Because he's either not involved at all, or he's a very good actor.
Rosie looks at Steve.
And I think we both know the answer to that.
Chapter 89. Dawn rises in the City of London. On the 80th floor of a building that nobody can mention for reasons of security, Amy, Jeff Nolan, and Susan Knox, Jeff's head of HR, sit at a boardroom table, files of paper spread out between them. The first rays of sun pick up dust in the air.
Every single one of them, says Amy.
35 clients, confirms Susan Knox, all of whom have worked for Vivid Viral and all of whom were introduced to Maximum Impact by Max Highfield. There are payments of 10 grand directly into his account for each of them. Amy leafs through the new file. This goes back just over 2 years. Name after name introduced by Highfield, including Courtney Lewis, where the whole plan began to unravel.
Are there details of any of the jobs they did? Jeff asks. Where they might have travelled and when?
Low-value clients, says Susan.
No one in this file could have afforded to have us accompany them on a trip.
That's why they were chosen.
Not a single clue, Amy asks.
The file is just names, numbers and addresses, says Susan.
Everything else must have gone through Vivid Viral, I suppose.
Then none of this brings us any closer to Loubet, says Amy. Jeff is studying something intently.
Max would have needed help.
Jesus, says Amy, who would be stupid enough to help Max Highfield? Jeff looks at Susan, and then at Amy. The sunlight now pierces the window blinds, throwing black stripes onto his face.
I think you know who, Amy.
What's happening here?
Amy feels like she's walking into a trap.
The first name on this list, says Jeff, was introduced to me by Max Highfield 3 days after he came back from a trip to San Francisco.
Come on, Amy starts. Now she sees.
Where his close protection officer, says Jeff, was Amy Wheeler.
Amy, says Susan.
And on the day that the second name on the list was introduced, who was Amy working for? Jeff pauses for an effect that is not needed, because they all know the answer.
Francois Loubet.
No, says Amy. We both know exactly what's happened here, Amy, says Jeff.
Chapter 90. Steve has never been in a sauna before, and he is fairly sure he never will be again. But he's investigating, and investigating always involves some sort of sacrifice. What he needs right now is a friendly introduction to Rob Kenner, and he has found just the man for the job. He sits on a bench diagonally opposite the big Cockney he'd seen playing golf with Rob yesterday. Could be an ex-cop, this fella. Open, dependable face, bald, red head, pouring with sweat.
Like a sauna in here, isn't it? Says Steve.
Mickey Moody smiles.
You sound like a Londoner.
Steve, says Steve, wondering if it was supposed to be this difficult to breathe.
Bermondsey, born and bred.
Mickey, says Mickey Moody.
Billericay.
You been playing?
Not a golfer, just love a sauna.
Really opens up the pores, says Steve. He has just been Googling saunas. Had a walk around the course, got my 10,000 steps in, then straight in here.
People don't normally wear T-shirts and shorts in the sauna, says Mickey.
I hear you, says Steve.
Or shoes, adds Mickey.
Steve had suspected all this, but he wasn't comfortable with any form of nudity, even feet.
Saw you playing with that DJ. Rob, what's name?
Mickey Moody looks at Steve more closely.
Rob Kenner? Did ya?
I'm not a cop. I'm just nosy, says Steve.
What's he like?
Mickey shrugs.
Don't care if you are a cop.
Dunno, really. We just play golf.
He seems all right. I've learnt not to ask too many questions of people around here.
Why's that? Steve asks.
What'd you do, Steve, for a job? Mickey asks.
Scented candles, says Steve, taking himself by surprise. Mickey nods.
I was in scrap for years. You meet a few characters there, says Steve.
You do, old son, you do, agrees Mickey. And that's the point. I learnt long ago not to ask anyone anything. Did my job, got paid, went home to the wife. People had come into the yard trying to sell you all sorts, brand new Ferraris, all stuff you wouldn't believe. Or they'd ask if you could leave the gate open at night and not look too closely at the crusher the next morning.
Sounds a lot like the scented candle business, says Steve.
Both men laugh, and Steve follows this up with a hacking cough from the overpowering eucalyptus fumes.
I always gave a polite no, says Mickey. No offence given, no offence taken, but I'm not your man. And one by one, these guys with the Ferraris and the dead bodies will get nicked or shot or get coked up and die in their pool. And there was me, nice little business, nice little ass, and now nice little retirement. Little villa by the golf course.
Never tempted.
A couple of years we struggled, says Mickey, and you start thinking, maybe, should I, you know? But it's not how I was born. I was raised by my grandmothers, and they'd have killed me.
Where do you live now, Steve?
Ormskirk, says Steve. Where did that come from?
Steve isn't even sure where Ormskirk is.
Near Liverpool?
Where's that? Mickey asks.
Up north.
Steve nods, hoping it is.
It's not exactly Dubai.
Nowhere is, says Mickey. This place reminds me of those days back in Essex, see?
Everybody's at it all day long. Speedboats and hot tubs and God knows what. Money coming out of their arses, the lot of them. So I don't ask, you know? Maybe it's all legitimate.
But Rob Kenner's just a DJ, Steve says.
Mickey holds up his hands.
Who knows? None of my business. I like playing golf with the fella. But one day, he won't be there anymore, I know that.
We used to play with a lad called Big Frank, fruit and veg importer. They found him dead in Colombia. Perhaps he was out there picking bananas. For a while, there was a lad called Gomez and he sold cars until he ended up in the boot of one in a quarry in Kent. Not so long ago, there was Davy. He got killed somewhere. They never found him. They come and go.
Are you really in the scented candle business?
Afraid so, says Steve, forcing himself to look at the naked cockney, as if being in a sauna was the most natural thing in the world. And just then, something rings a bell deep within him. What is it?
Heroin on the side? Asks Mickey. People trafficking?
Just candles, says Steve.
You're one of the smart ones then, says Mickey. Take a good look around Dubai. There ain't many of us left.
Mickey would have made a good cop. Cops weren't allowed tattoos in Steve's day, though. Change now. Tattoos, beards, the lot. How to finesse this? Steve needs to speak to Rob Kenner. And it has to be an accidental meeting, an introduction from an old friend. But is Mickey Moody too wily for all that? He needs a bit of peace and quiet so he can talk this whole thing through with Debbie.
You okay there, fella? Mickey asks.
Sorry, miles away, says Steve.
Is your wife still alive, Mickey?
Died, says Mickey. Cancer, 5 years back.
Sorry, says Steve.
Same boat.
Mickey nods, then looks towards the door as if making sure no one is about to come in.
You ever talk to her?
Steve also looks at the door, then back at Mickey.
All day, every day.
You?
I was talking to her when you walked in, says Mickey. I was telling her about the putt I made on that 18th.
Steve smiles.
Sorry to have interrupted you.
Mickey smiles too.
She don't mind. She loved a scented candle. Don't believe in them myself, no offence.
What does she make of Rob Kenner?
Thinks he's a wide boy, says Mickey. Tells me to steer well clear. Jabbers away.
You see, Debbie, Steve thinks, it's not just me. I'm not the only mad one.
And then he realises what the ringing bell is.
You're talking to your wife now, says Mickey.
I can see it.
Steve nods.
She telling you to whip your shoes off?
Steve laughs.
That's exactly what Debbie would say.
But what Debs is actually saying, right this very second, is, you clever bugger, Steve. You know who Francois Loubet is, don't you?
Steve closes his eyes and smiles because, yes, he does know.
He'll need a bit more evidence, sure, but at least he knows exactly what's happened now.
He can't wait to tell Rosie and Amy and work out what on earth they're going to do next.
Steve kicks off his shoes and peels off his socks, feet as naked as the day he was born. Let no one say he doesn't know how to celebrate.
That's the stuff, says Mickey.
Chapter 91.
I can call the police, says Susan to Jeff, or you might prefer to deal with this yourself.
Amy wishes she was back in that car boot, curled up. What's her play here? She goes through Jeff's checklist. Point one, assess the situation. Point two, assess your strengths. Point three, Jeff pulls a gun from his jacket and points it at Amy. So much for the checklist. Amy immediately does the same.
Thank you, Gary Goff. It turns out she did need the gun.
Susan Knox eyes them both. "Okay, children," she says, "I'm calling the police." "No," say both Amy and Jeff, guns trained on each other.
"Get out of this one, Amy."
"Put the gun down, Amy," says Susan. Amy thinks about how nice it would be for Steve to come through the door right now. He would know what to do. Amy is at a loss, because Jeff's training is her training. They each cancel the other out. So what would Steve do?
"Put it down, Amy," says Jeff, "and let's talk.
Persuade me it wasn't you." Amy shakes her head.
"Someone was helping Max Highfield," says Jeff.
"Please let me call the police," says Susan. "I'm sure they'd happily ask Amy all of these questions."
"No," say Jeff and Amy again. "It's all there in the files, Amy," says Jeff. "I should have seen it before. You work for Highfield. You worked for Lube."
"So did you," says Amy.
"I'm not going through all that again," says Jeff.
If Steve was in the room, what would he do? What would he notice? What's wrong here?
"But why didn't you notice 35 separate payments to Max Highfield, Jeff?" asks Amy.
"None of my business," says Jeff.
"Why would I even look? That's what Susan's for."
"Don't drag me into this," says Susan.
Amy is making no progress here, so perhaps the time for "what would Steve do" is over. Sure, Jeff trained her, but hasn't she learnt a few things of her own? Perhaps it's actually time for "what would Amy do?" Here goes nothing.
"You recruited those clients yourself, Jeff," says Amy.
"That's what I think. You set Max Highfield up to cover your own tracks. You set up those payments to him in case somebody came snooping. You set up a deal with Vivid Viral because you always take care of the little details. And, of course, you were in contact with Francois Lube all along."
"You think I sent emails to myself," says Jeff. "You think I paid someone to drive a car through the windows of Bruno's?"
"That's exactly what I think," says Amy, then speaks to Susan without turning away from Jeff.
"Susan, if we looked at those files, could we tell if all those payments to Max Highfield were authorised personally by Jeff?"
"We could," says Susan, "but it would take half an hour or so. Why don't you both put the guns down, and I can—"
"No time," says Amy. She lowers her gun to the floor, then raises it a notch, and shoots Jeff Nolan in the leg. Jeff fires back as he falls, but the bullet misses wildly. Amy is on him in an instant, and cable ties his hands as he thrashes on the floor.
"Get up," says Amy, gun pointed at his head. "We're going for a drive. Susan, if